WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
If it's Monday night, it's got to be Monday Night Talk with Kevin Tachi. So thanks for having me on.
Kevin, good for you to hold back and let him tell his story.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
You guys are the center of the universe today, at least the political universe.
I believe both of you are from the area. Marshfield guys, yes, no?
Correct, yeah.
That's right.
There's only one person not from Marshfield in this room right now. And it's you.
It's me. I'm the outcast.
Well, you've always been generous with the time. I appreciate it very much.
Well, I'm honored to be on your show tonight, Kevin, with that impressive lineup you have.
I believe our guest that we've been waiting for, Congressman Stephen Lynch.
Kevin, good to join you.
The governor of the Commonwealth, Charlie Baker. You ready?
I got to tell you that it was really nice to hear Aerosmith on the intro there.
You're going
to
be the rock and roll governor?
I don't know about that, but...
We have Mayor Joe Sullivan joining us. Sir, how are you?
Well, Kevin, very good to be with you again.
Dr. Drew Pinsky. Dr. Drew, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Mr. Ming Tsai, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Massachusetts State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Hello, Auditor. How are you?
I am fine, and I'm delighted to be with you this evening.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi.
I'm WATD. Hi. Again, we'll pretend to start over. Welcome. You are tuned into Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD. Just a small hiccup, but we've got it fixed. Live from Broadcast House, we hope all is well with you as we are all trying to survive Omicron and Florona and anything else that happens to spin itself. We have a great informational radio program. Of course, my first guest is already here, State Senator John Keenan. Senator, how are you?
Great, great. Great to be here. Thanks, Kevin.
Good health?
Yes, thankfully, yes.
Knock on plywood?
It's tough these days, but yes.
And you know what? I want to give a round of applause to Larry Nelson, who is doing yeoman's work, the marathon man here at Broadcast House, as he is producing my radio program tonight. Larry, thank you very much for... doing double duty, my friend, not only in the morning, but also in the evenings. Other than State Senator John Keenan, who will be coming up in just a few moments after traffic, we have Jeffrey Yelenesian from Bread and Smoke Shop. We know Jeffrey as being very vocal. Knowing that he's a business owner, we had him on to get his finger on the pulse. He was interested because we had Jeff Deal on. You know that we have a gubernatorial race. It's wide open. Jeff wanted to come on and talk about... the gubernatorial race and the state of business these days. So I said, come on in, seeing that he's one of our sponsors, our traffic at 6:20. Hour number two, we have a little bit of a Council on Aging discussion. We speak with Tammy Murray, who is the Director of Community Services and the Council on Aging in Hanover. It's soon going to be part of your district, isn't it?
If the election goes well, yes.
Yes. So, Tammy is being joined by Susan Curtin, who is the director for the Noble Council on Aging. And we'll find out how things are going with the Council on Aging's with the most recent spike that we have seen of this pandemic. And then we'll wrap things up with a little bit of an author talk. Par Mims, she's the author of The Captive, and we will chat with her about her new book, what it's like to be an author, and the details as to putting together a book. It's always interesting to hear folks how they decide that they want to sit down, put pen to paper, and craft a book. Some folks have a different way of going about it than some others. So we look forward to that. That's coming up in just a few moments. How was the ride down here, Senator?
It wasn't bad. Yeah, about 26 minutes. I think is what it was. They told me my arrival time was 6:06. I think I arrived about 6:02.
You did. So just before we do check traffic, what was your day like up on the hill?
Busy day. The second half of the day was consumed by a Transportation Committee hearing where we had, I think, about 12, 13 different types of bills before us and a pretty long list of people to testify. So it was about a 2.5-hour hearing. Very interesting. And then this morning, focused on some housing issues, some office issues. So a busy day.
Any updates regarding the Red Line or the MBTA to talk about at all, or nothing to this point?
No, there's a concern. Not much to talk about in terms of its day-to-day use. The numbers are still down, but they're rebounding slightly across all modes of transportation. That meaning commuter rail, subway, buses. Buses have been the most resilient. The numbers are increasing, but there is still a concern going about two fiscal years as to what's going to happen with the MBTA. The federal money will certainly help in the short term, but there are some revenue issues that the MBTA and the Commonwealth are going to have to confront in starting in fiscal year 2024 and thereabouts.
It's, you know, since the pandemic has hit, it's kind of, it, you know, when we look at folks and when they're commuting and what they're doing for employment, you know, one of our sponsors happens to own a restaurant, and he's had to close down for a couple of days a week because there's a shortage in help and folks, you know, deciding that they want to change careers, you know, in the middle, you know, midstream of their life, and saw this as an opportunity to do so.
Sure. Just as an example, back when we brought my son to return to college back in, it was Parents Weekend back in the fall. We were out in Milwaukee. He goes to Marquette University, and we took an Uber to the airport. And the woman who was driving an Uber had been a bus driver for 20-something years for the public schools. And she said because of the pandemic, she took a step back. She was temporarily driving Uber. She was changing careers. She wasn't sure what she wanted to do, but she knew after 20 years, given her physical health and exposure to children, that she wasn't quite ready to return as a bus driver. And I think that's kind of what's going on out there. People are rethinking careers.
Yeah, it definitely, it's interesting. And you know, we're not out of the woods yet, especially when it comes to COVID. I mean, what are you hearing from your district, and what are you discussing up on the Hill in regards to where things are? I mean, we've seen a spike over the past, 2 weeks, where numbers are I think, higher than they were back in 2020.
The spike has been rather dramatic. Hospitalizations have gone up. Thankfully, the condition of people being hospitalized isn't as severe as what it was. Death numbers, while they are high, very high, they would expect it to be higher given the rate of infection, but thankfully they're not. The big issue with the hospitals is staffing and being able to meet the demands not only of COVID-related illness, but other illnesses as well. And so the combination of those is making it quite impactful what's going on. And then you just hear people are getting sick. A year ago at this time, you kind of knew somebody, you knew somebody else. Now it's who do you know that hasn't been infected recently, isn't dealing with COVID right now. It's a pretty dramatic difference.
Yeah, it's an interesting dilemma that we're living here in our society and culturally. I think it's time for us. We'll take a quick pause right here. Senator Keenan will join us back in just a moment, but time for us to find out what's happening one final time out on the roadways. Being brought to you on this end by Brennan Smoke Shop with locations in Plymouth, Pembroke, Brockton, Wareham, Raynham, Taunton, Stoughton, New Bedford, Weymouth, and now in Hudson, New Hampshire. I believe we have, who do we have up? Renee Hamilton joining us. How are things out on the roadway, Renee?
Well, Kevin, we have just one issue on the Cape, and this report is sponsored by Whole Foods Market. 6 eastbound is slowing in Sandwich. We have a new crash before 1:30. That ties you up for about half a mile, but once you get by, Route 6 is all clear, and there are no other issues on the Cape. Route 3 southbound is moving along at the speed limit from Braintree to the Sagamore Bridge. Northbound, more of the same, back up into Braintree. 495, 44, they're both in good shape. On 24 southbound, you're doing fine from 93 down past 495. And the expressway southbound, that's all clear from the tunnel to the split. Northbound, wide open all the way up into the city. At Whole Foods Market, get organic Honeycrisp apples for $2.99 a pound through January 11th, plus an extra 10% off for Prime members while supplies last. See more on the Whole Foods Market app. Traffic on the nines every morning. I'm Renee in the WATD Traffic Center.
I am so stressed out. The school, home, bills, government, economy, gas prices, vaccines. It is so hard to get anything done and so stressful. We are all stretched to the max with no end in sight. We're all saying the same thing to one another. This is crazy. I'm not the bringer of bad news. I bring good news. And the good news is we're all in this together. And I actually find comfort in that. So let's all take these stress-relieving, mindful breaths together. Don't change the channel. Shh. Take a breath. I'm inhaling. I'm exhaling. Brennan Smoke Shop. Have a great day.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
right. We are back and joining back into the conversation with State Senator John Keenan, who is my guest, the first State House report, as we've done for, I think, 10 years now on this radio program after we reformatted after a one-time colleague of yours, Senator Hedlund, who is now Mayor Hedlund. So we jump from talking a little bit about the COVID to talking redistricting, which is going to be interesting. I believe that your colleagues voted 36-3 to go along with the redistricting plan. What does that mean for the particular district that you're currently serving?
So the Norfolk and Plymouth District was the city of Quincy and then the communities of Abington, Braintree, Holbrook, and Rockland, those towns. And initially, when the numbers came in from the census, it looked as if the district was essentially going to stay the same. But upon further review and given the goal of making a majority-minority district over in Brockton, it resulted in a bit of a change. And so the Norfolk and Plymouth District now will be still Quincy in its entirety. It will go from 9 precincts in Braintree to 3, and then it will still be Holbrook, Abington, and Rockland, and Hanover will be added to the district. So that's the big difference.
And so, I mean, how does it feel as far as knowing that you probably know your district so well that if you are successful come this November, that you're going to have to somewhat get acclimated to the newer parts that are, make up your district?
Yeah, I don't think it'll be a big adjustment. Hopefully I'll get reelected, and we'll let the voters of the district make that decision at the appropriate time. But in anticipation of that, I've done some outreach in Hanover trying to get to know more people there. But I'm pretty familiar with it. I've had 3 siblings who have lived it for a long time in Hanover. Actually, one just recently moved, but 2 have been there for years. Their children were raised in Hanover, so we're down there all the time at family get-togethers and things like that. So pretty familiar with the town in that respect. And what I've found is, regardless of the town, the issues generally are the same. People want to make sure that they get local aid from the Commonwealth to help with police, with fire, with their library, veteran services, senior buildings and programs, and with education. They want to make sure that they get the Chapter 90 money that comes from the state to help with roads, to make sure that the roads are in good condition. So the concerns, regardless of the community, are essentially the same. Each community has a little bit different character and may have a slight difference in the issues, but generally they're pretty similar.
Let's talk a little bit about something that's coming up this Wednesday. I believe that there's a legislative briefing. This is on S-686. This is in regards to folks who are in the Commonwealth are currently living with multiple sclerosis.
Yes. I worked with a person several years ago who was diagnosed with MS. And in the course of the diagnosis and then determining a course of treatment, there was a period where medications would be changed. Sometime because they're just trying to figure out the right medication, and other times it might be caused by insurance. And people face that. People with MS face that pretty regularly. If they change jobs, or if a spouse changed their job, or any whoever's providing the insurance, their insurance may change, and that results in the insurance company saying, well, we want you to try this medication. Or it might be that their existing insurance company changes the formulary and moves the drug into a different tier and says, well, before you go up to that, we want to have you switch off what you're using and try something else. And in many cases, that throws off the entire treatment process. And with MS, if you are stabilized and your medication changes and you regress, you cannot get back what you lost. You can stabilize again, but you will not get back, in most cases, what you lost. And so the change of medication has a really incredibly significant impact on the lives of people with MS. So the legislation that we have filed would require insurance companies basically to keep people on the medication that works best for them, so that if somebody changes their insurance, they will get the same medication. If there's a change in the insurance policy that puts the drugs in different categories, they will still have access to that same medication. And the insurance companies can't raise copays and things like that in an effort to move somebody off. They've got to provide it basically in as fair a manner as possible. So it allows MS patients who have found the right medication under just about every circumstance to stay on that medication so that they can get through the day and live their lives and do their best they can to combat this disease.
How did you come to get involved in want to craft or create or support a bill like this? What's the story behind that?
It was really the story of the person that I worked with, and then doing a little bit of research, and we found out that in the district there is a pharmaceutical company, EMD Serono, that makes an MS drug. And so we approached them to kind of get their take on it, and they told us what's going on in the pharmaceutical industry relative to MS medications. And so it just seemed to come together that there was an identified need, a personal connection to it, a company that was able to provide us with some information, and then recognition as we got involved that the problem was pretty widespread. And on the briefing that we'll have this Wednesday, we will hear from people who have been impacted by changes in medications or who are fearful of changes in medications. And their stories are really incredibly compelling as to how important it is that they have access to the same medication, the medications that has been shown to work for each of them.
You actually have some testimonials on your website that are very interesting. Are any of those individuals going to speak to this as well as to having to deal and have to deal with insurance companies in order to ask to stay, retain the medication and keep that continuity?
Yes. Those individuals, they were filmed by Peter Jasinski, who works in my office. He went out and interviewed them.
He does a great job.
He did an incredible job of talking with them about what they've been dealing with, what they have to confront on a daily basis, and getting it recorded. And those recordings will be part of the briefing on the 12th. And I think they're going to show people that dealing with MS on a daily basis is complicated and difficult enough that people don't need the added stress of changes or potential changes in medication. So, yes, those people that you've seen on the website giving testimony will be presented through that video testimony, and then also live or virtual, they will be available to answer questions and to talk further about what they've confronted.
Now, is right now the bill in committee, and this is for the committee that is set deciding whether how they're going to report out?
Yes. So we're calling it a briefing, and the idea is to get as much attention on the bill as possible. We've invited other legislators. We've invited staff from other legislative offices. And I have two folks in the House of Representatives, Representative Sean Gobley and Representative John Lawn, who are co-sponsors of this legislation. So they have been working with the members of the House, all to bring attention, all to bring focus to this critical issue with the idea that this legislation should move forward.
And is the idea for this legislation to have some teeth to it? Well, I mean, what ultimately happens in regards to the insurance companies? Is there some kind of fine? How does the state get involved ultimately?
The state has pretty broad authority over insurance companies and how they go about their business, whether it's in rate setting or coverages that are provided.
Right.
The state often mandates certain coverages for insurance companies. Insurance companies don't like that. They don't want to be told.
Right.
But we've been working with the insurance companies, with the insurance plan, the association that deals with all the insurance companies, and they've been helpful. They recognize that this is a need, and they have been helpful. We've been working on language with them and talking about the impact on the insurance companies and providing this medication, and they've become really good partners in this.
So what could happen after you have your briefing on the 12th? Any expectations? Have you been told anything by the chairperson as to what depending on what they hear and see?
There's been no guarantees or promises.
Absolutely.
Because there's so many bills. There's over 6,400 bills that are working their way through the legislative process presently. And most of those bills there'll be some action taken on those bills the first Wednesday in February. That's the Joint Rule 10 day. That's the date by which committees have to either report a bill out favorably, send the bill to study for additional work, or hold the bill in committee perhaps for more work over the next couple of months. So there's a real push on it this time on all kinds of legislation to get favorable committee reports. And so that's the idea behind this briefing, is to put the words of people who deal with MS behind the legislation, and with the hope that we will move it out of committee and through the next committees and onto the House and Senate floor.
Is this a refile, or has this been filed previous times?
We filed it, I think, for the first time last session, did an awful lot of work with the insurance companies on it, trying to refine the language to make sure that we had everything covered. And so, yes, it was filed last session. This is, I think, the second session that we have filed it.
Now, is there a way for, can folks watch this, or can they get involved? What are you looking for as far as getting the word out about this legislative briefing?
Yes, yeah, so they can go to the Commonwealth's website, and they'll the legislature's website, and they'll be able to find the link to the briefing. And if they have any information, they can certainly contact my office, and we can get them the information to that briefing, and they can email me at john.keenan@masenate.gov, and we'll get them the information. So if they want to watch the briefing, they can. And also the briefing, we'll have it on tape, so people will be able to watch it there as well.
Fantastic. Moving on, and we best of luck, and hopefully next time we have you in here, we can get an update as to the movement on this particular legislation. There was another one that kind of sparked my interest, and I know how much work you have done in regards to folks who are in recovery, folks who are battling addiction, and that is an act relative to recovery coach licensure. Where's this piece of legislation at this particular time?
This too is also in committee, and recovery coaches are people who are often recovery themselves, who, because of what they've experienced, are particularly suited and very interested in helping others. So they become recovery coaches. They're there pretty much every step of the way to help somebody through recovering, and they're using their lived experience to do so. They are not often covered by insurance. Their services are not covered by insurance. And there's really no professional licensure that kind of puts them into a category that will then permit or allow or make insurance companies feel more comfortable in providing coverage for the services that that are offered or given through these recovery coaches. So the first step would be to get them through a certification, a licensure program, and then ultimately to make sure that the services they provide are covered. I was at a vigil in Holbrook back, I guess, you know, time flies, I don't even know, it might have been during the summer at some point, I can't remember now. But, and it was brought up, a woman approached me and said, you know what we really need, she said, especially with the pandemic and so many people falling back into addiction, is we need people to help them through the process. We desperately need recovery coaches. And that highlighted to me the importance of this bill, which we had filed, but highlighted the importance of the bill. People really need somebody to talk to, somebody to give them guidance. AA is well known for having its sponsor program. Recovery coaches act in a similar way, but provide a broader range of services. And so it's really important, and we're hopeful that this bill will move, that it will make its way through the process, and that we'll come up with a licensing certification program, and then also with insurance coverage. And that should serve then to attract more people to the profession.
Has studies been done in regards to having that added layer of peer-to-peer support, the ability to kind of help folks at least maintain on the road to recovery?
Yeah, the studies are starting to come out now, and this has been a little bit more present in the other side of the behavioral health field, which is in mental health. There's been a lot more peer-to-peer coaching and peer-to-peer counseling on that side. And the results show that somebody with lived experience really is able to connect with somebody in recovery and to help them through recovery.
What are you hearing in regards to, here we're dealing with the pandemic, we're going into year three on this, and have you been, knowing that you're somebody who's been working so hard in regards to folks who are battling addiction, what are you hearing for what do you have for data?
The number of opioid overdose deaths in Massachusetts has climbed. It reverses the trend that we were on. A lot of the work that we've done over the last 10 years was showing results in terms of overdose deaths and overdoses in general, and we were encouraged by that. And then the pandemic hit, and people who had access to treatment and recovery services or even harm reduction services, they no longer had that access. They were in isolation. And when somebody's using an opioid, intravenously fentanyl in particular, right, by themselves, the likelihood of an overdose is just so much greater. And we had more people by themselves cut off from the services that they had been using. And as a result, they went back into drug use and then to overdoses. I was in Boston one point. There's been so much attention on the Alnia Cass and Mass Ave, and during the pandemic, I went down to that area long before the most recent crisis. I would go down there periodically and just walk the streets and talk to people. And I asked a woman in particular, I said, how are things down here? And she said it had just been an incredibly difficult summer. So many people that she knew that had been in recovery or had been on the verge of going to recovery slid back into active use. And she said the number of overdose deaths down here, she says, it doesn't seem to end. And so it's really tragic. And that's Milneac Acid Mass Ave. But for every person that's living in a tent there, there's somebody who wakes up in the morning and uses IV drugs, fentanyl, in their kitchen and is at risk of overdose. There's people at lunch breaks who do it. So it's not just people on the streets. It's people that are in our communities and people that we know that sometimes we're unaware of until all of a sudden we hear that they've died of an overdose.
It was too long ago that $4.4 billion ARPA money was signed and voted on. Can any of those monies be put towards the problems we're seeing with addiction?
Yes, there's been substantial commitment to it in so many different ways, not only in direct treatment and harm reduction. There's been a commitment to provide housing services for those who are struggling with addiction. So there's been a broad approach to using the ARPA funds to help people who are struggling with addiction, behavioral health problems overall.
What about as far as like nonprofits who provide great support out? Would they be eligible for funding
yes.
in that area?
Yes. There's a lot of money available, and we still have ARPA money at our disposal. And over the course of the next several months, we'll be working in the legislature to determine the next use of ARPA funds. For instance, one of the issues that we're confronted with now is the housing situation, where there has been a pretty substantial amount of money available to help those avoid eviction. It's money that keeps tenants in their units and keeps landlords as whole as possible. That money is now drying up, and that's part of, is such a foundational thing for people that absent housing, they're more likely to have behavioral health, mental health, substance use issues. And so there's been a renewed focus in the last few weeks on how much of that money is going to be available over the next several months to get through this latest surge and to make sure that people can stay in their homes.
If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with State Senator John Keenan. He is our guest for the State House Report. I just got a couple minute or two left here. Anything that we haven't mentioned during this segment, but you want to take a moment to make sure you mentioned to the folks who are tuned in, whether it's constituents or just folks who care about general government?
Just know that we're working hard. Unfortunately, we're not back at the State House, and I think we miss a lot in terms of government by not being there. Mm. The one-on-one contact with fellow legislators and people coming into the office is really important. But we've adjusted. We've done office hours out in the district. We've done virtual office hours. I stay in regular contact with my colleagues. I'm in the State House pretty frequently. My staff has been in the State House regularly. So we're still trying to keep the wheels of government turning. And we're there for anybody. The folks in my office have done an incredible job of responding to constituent requests. At first, it was for unemployment benefits. Then it was housing. And it seems to change periodically as to what the need is. But we're there for people. They can call us at 617-722-1494, and we're happy to help. There's such great need out there. There are resources available. So we urge people to reach out by email, by telephone, and we will help them as best we can. We'll put them in touch with the right people.
Senator, thank you so much for coming in. Probably a big thank you to Peter, who yes. was quick when I reached out to him saying, hey, love to have the Senator on. He goes, yep, let's make this happen. And here it is. We're here talking about stuff. So, again, we look forward to having you back on in the near future.
Great.
And continued good health.
Same to you. Stay well.
You got it. All right. We're going to step aside just for a moment. But when we come back, more Monday Night Talk.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
Each year, about one out of two men and one out of three women will develop cancer. But there's good news. Today's cancer survival odds are much better than 2 or even 3 years ago. Things move that fast. So if you're diagnosed, be sure to have someone in your corner who is on top of all the latest cancer treatments and techniques, the latest research, the newest equipment, all the newest medicines available through clinical trials. And speaking of corners, here's more good news. Advanced Cancer Care is now just around the corner. The Green Cancer Center at Signature Healthcare treats patients locally, with all oncology services and specialties conveniently housed under one roof. The center is affiliated with Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, so you'll be seen by Harvard Medical faculty physicians and oncologists. The Green Cancer Center at Signature Healthcare, in affiliation with Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Cancer has just met its match. Find out why at mysignaturecare.org/cancercare.
Creamy nut butter makes it delightfully sweet. Roasted nuts make it perfectly salty. Get two great tastes in one delicious bar. Enjoy a Nature Valley Sweet and Salty Nut Bar today.
Would you like a cleaning product that can be used in the garage, the laundry, and the kitchen, and save space in your cabinet? Hi, I'm Bruce Fabrizio, inventor of Simple Green. To learn more, visit us at simplegreen.com.
I know you've been waiting a little bit longer than normal.
Jen's manicure spot needs an extra pair of hands.
Who's at the front desk right now?
Someone who's handy with everything from nail files to spreadsheet files.
Deidre's not coming in today, but we have that whole bachelorette
party. Indeed can help her hire great people fast.
I need Indeed.
Indeed you do. Instant Match instantly connects you with quality candidates whose resumes on Indeed match your sponsored job description. Visit Indeed.com/credit and get $75 towards your first sponsored job. Terms and conditions apply.
Download the Monday Night Talk podcast from iTunes for free. Just search for Monday Night Talk, WATD. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
Okay, and we return for more Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD. And as I love to do proudly, we have folks who are generous enough to understand the value of local radio, what it is that we provide to the audience and their opportunity to speak with them through various messages with commercials. And again, they also support what we do as local content, not just, you know, an opportunity to say, hey, buy this, come here, do that. But also that, you know, we have other things like local news and radio shows. Joining us is a premier sponsor. He sponsors our traffic, as he just did about 22 minutes ago. He is Jeff Yelnesian. He is the gentleman from Brennan Smoke Shop, not only with several locations here in Massachusetts, but just over the border in Hudson, New Hampshire. Happy New Year, Jeff.
Happy New Year, Kevin. Happy New Year, South Shore.
So the idea of having Jeff on isn't to sit and talk about his new stores necessarily, although he's more than welcome to talk about how business has either flourished or has had its struggles during COVID. But I thought Jeff, as a local businessman, knowing that there are several races that are going to be taking place, political races here in the state of Massachusetts, he's very active. I want to give Jeff a voice as a businessman who has at times vented his frustration at various administrations for how they handle businesses. Jeff, you know, first question out the door. What are you looking forward to this coming year for political races and some of the candidates who are going to throw their hat in the ring to best represent the Commonwealth?
Kevin.
Yes.
Charlie Baker's not running, is he?
We're good.
We're good,
yes.
We're good. You know, Kevin, my mom said years ago, you don't mix business with politics. And I'm not necessarily trying to mix business with politics. But in my business, that's so highly regulated, it's hard not to mix business with politics. And it's funny because every legislative session, tobacco comes up, and every legislative session we have to fight or at least tussle with legislative representatives and senators.
We know
a chance to rub shoulders with the governor.
Well, here's the thing though, Jeff, is I know over the past 4 years, it has been particularly tough for anybody who, you know, you can have your opinion in regards to tobacco, flavored tobacco, vaping, but I know over the past 4 years, it has been tough
for folks like yourself to be able to manage and be able to provide product for folks who are seeking it here in the Commonwealth?
30 years, Kevin. We've been in the business for 30 years, and I was very young when my mom started this company, but I've seen it for 30 years. It's been a struggle for my mom, for me, for us. And I don't even know how we have done what we've done. I don't know how I did it. It's pretty crazy. But it's been a struggle for years and years and years. And people hear me say billions of dollars lost to over the border sales and tax revenue, billions. And I had a meeting with Senator Keenan of Braintree District, and he made a statement that, you know, if we leave the door open with this flavor ban, then it'll swing wide open. And I said to him, you never close the door. For 30 years, people have been going over the border, not just for tobacco, but for all kinds of things. The border of New Hampshire, because it's tax-free. Kevin, I can't believe now that we have this store open in New Hampshire, first of all, that that we had to do that to stay alive in this business, or at least be able to continue to provide tobacco, legal products to consumers in the Commonwealth. I forget where I was going, but it's crazy. Can you back me up here a little bit? Where was I heading? Where was I heading with that? I lose my train of thought. There's so much. Senator Keenan, and the door never being closed. He claimed that all of the sales, they knew that they were going to lose money to over the border. I'm like, so you knew you were giving money away? Yeah, we knew we were going to lose. But as we look, the sales on the border have kind of come down, and it's he kind of, I don't want to say he lied to me, but he kind of fiddled with the statistics. My statistics are sales overall on the New Hampshire border are up 300%. His suggested that they weren't up quite as much, and that we weren't losing as much as we were. And he kind of battered against my $1 billion statement. And I said, no, Senator Keenan, this has been going on for 30 years. Online mail order sales, tax-free tobacco flooding into the state, tax-free tobacco coming into the state over the border of used to be just New Hampshire. Now you have Rhode Island and New Hampshire and Connecticut. Tobacco, tax revenue streaming out on a regular basis, 24/7, tobacco tax revenue flowing out and tax-free tobacco flowing in.
Can I fairly say this? And I think it's indicative of the Commonwealth. It seems as though a lot of times, while the Commonwealth of Massachusetts can be on the front lines and be on the forefront of so many different initiatives like carbon emissions or education or anything like that, it seems as though that sometimes our lawmakers, administrations here in Massachusetts are late to some other parties, such as marijuana, such as gaming, right? And we've seen both of those where Massachusetts has finally stepped in. You have casinos that are here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. You do have medical marijuana and adult recreation marijuana, albeit, I would say I saw a recent article that sales in Massachusetts aren't as robust as they expected. Well, when you have other avenues, you're a little late into the game, either that or maybe the projections are a little high. I would say that Massachusetts has, again, on some fronts, has been late to the party when they could have been front and center and been reaping those revenues to help with the Commonwealth.
It's money.
It's money. And, but I think what I want to do is I want to guide you and navigate you, and you know, knowing that there are going to be a handful of candidates that are going to be out there looking to gain support. Are there any names? Is there any individuals that come to mind that have impressed you early on so far at this point?
Well, we live in a small state, and most of us are from small towns. You have this backdrop, I see, because we're doing this on Zoom. I don't know if anybody knew that. We're doing this on Zoom because of COVID, and you have this backdrop of Boston.
I do.
That's not Massachusetts. Massachusetts out here in the cities and towns. I mean, in the small cities and towns. All right, it's not Massachusetts. It's not Boston. And I've had two people call me in my years of being a tobacco guy. Bob Hedlund wanted to know how the novelty lighter ban was going to affect us. And then recently, former Representative Jeffrey Deal called me. And it was funny how I was at the store, and I never take calls at the store, and I heard my manager writing down a message. Okay, Jeffrey Deal. And I said, Jeff Deal's on the phone? Is this Jeff Deal? Yes. And as it were, it was really Jeff Deal. And he's concerned about small businesses in Massachusetts. I'm concerned not only for mine, but a lot of others. Restaurant, bars, vape shops got creamed by Charlie Baker. And all of these restaurants and bars continue to get creamed by Charlie Baker, who's just seems to be removed or naive to the small town people that really make up Massachusetts. He's in the clouds, some big insurance company. He's all set. He's got millions of dollars, his nice house, his big cushy job waiting for him with the healthcare industry. He's a healthcare guy. He duped everybody into thinking he's conservative. And this is what I hate. And I hate labeling people, but he had us all duped into thinking that he was going to stand up for rights, freedoms, and liberties, and he's done nothing but tear it up and stomp on it.
You not think, though, it's tough to be, you know, knowing that this is a liberal state. Massachusetts is liberal, and it's tough to gain traction as somebody who is a conservative, even if you are a moderate conservative. You don't think that you have to kind of stray the line? I mean, I think that Charlie Baker has gained success by boring that line between being a moderate conservative and trying to breach being a liberal at the same time. You know, again, that may be the reason why he did not seek a third term. I mean, we've had radio programs and segments talking about that maybe he was not able to gain enough support from his very own party because he is, you know, he's one of those candidates that it's hard to put a finger on. And these days, if you're not trending far right or far left, you're kind of in the gray matter that's called
doesn't being exist. A politician.
Yeah.
Well, right. You don't really matter. Charlie Baker's got a job waiting for him. He always did that pays more money. Why would he continue to manage this mess when he's got money waiting? I mean, it all comes down to one thing.
But Jeff, do you know that? But I mean, do you know that for sure? I mean, nobody knows.
No, but I mean, it's speculation. We're all speculating.
Okay. Well, I mean, speculatively or not, I mean, regardless, he is not a part of the picture going forward to be the next governor of Massachusetts or be a returning, you know.
All I can say, Kevin, is Jeff Deal called me, and I saw that you had him on last week. Jeff Deal called me. Mm. I really respected that a lot. And he asked me to campaign with him, and I went to campaign with him, and he's one of us. He's like he's just a regular guy that's concerned like the rest of us. Liberal, conservative. He's not a career politician. He is a good American guy that is concerned and wants to do good for his community, the small towns of Massachusetts, not the big city. You know, he wants to do good for the people that he's rubbing shoulders with, that he's working with every day.
But do you feel that he's, I mean, here's the thing, and I'm going to throw this out there. And that is that I don't disagree with you. I know Jeff, nice enough guy, but depending on who you affiliate yourself with, who you support, We know that our last president was somebody who was, you know, he wasn't your normal politician. He was somebody who a lot of folks.
He was rude. He was rude.
He was rude. He wasn't, you're right. You can use that as a word, but I think there's a better word, and that is that he was unconventional as a candidate. And you know, again, there are folks who are not Republican. I mean, so even folks within the same party are fighting about whether or not to support a candidate who is that extreme.
I feel like in Massachusetts, the governor's position isn't necessarily a party position. And that's why I think we're talking about it. Because if it was, Charlie Baker wouldn't be in office right now, honestly, because, I mean, we're that blue. And I understand that. Just so we're all clear, I'm not campaigning for the Republican Party. I'm campaigning for Jeff Diehl because I like the guy a lot. I met Charlie Baker once, and I can't honest or twice, and I can't honestly say, wow, what a likable guy he was. He's so interesting and talkative. He's very dull, and you know, that's my personal perspective.
But that's the thing.
Diehl's a regular guy.
But Jeff, who is supported and supported Donald Trump, and has actually received an endorsement from the former president. I mean, is that something where it could hurt him in the long run, even if he has great policies?
I don't know. Generally in politics, I know how people feel about the Trump campaign, but look at the support there. So I think there's a lot of closet Trump supporters all over the country. So I don't know if it helps or hinders him. I don't know. I just like the guy.
Okay. So let me.
I'm not paying attention to the. You know what? I kind of liked him and campaigned with him that one day before he was endorsed. I think Trump endorsed him the day before we're actually supposed to campaign, but I was lined up before that. You know, so I don't really pay attention to any of that stuff. I actually voted for Deval Patrick the first term, just so we're clear. I'm an independent.
Right.
Actually, I registered Republican because I'm really trying to help Jeff. Because I really like the guy. I like his name too, Geoff. I always know my friend when they go, hey, Geoff. I know right away that's my friend behind me.
And if you are just tuned in, we're speaking with Jeff Yelenesian. He is with the Brendan Smoke Shop. You hear us to the spots here on 95.9. WATD is a sponsor of our traffic report here on Monday nights.
Just to clear it up, Kevy, yeah. Brennan is my mother's maiden name, just so you all know. My last name is not Brennan. It's Yelenesian.
Right.
It's Armenian.
Right. I did say that. With Brennan's Smoke Shop. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So we just got a minute or two left here, but I want to give you an opportunity. Any other candidates that have reached out to you, or do you encourage candidates to reach out to a business guy like yourself and other businesses?
I think that's the greatest takeaway from here is that feeling like these candidates are paying attention to every small business, you know, the small clothing store in Plymouth Center, you know, the gun shop, the tobacco store, the liquor store, the bar, the restaurant, you know, all the things that make culturally Massachusetts so great. You know, I think that's a good, campaign strategy is, you know, caring about your constituents.
Probably the only problem is that we've seen due to COVID, we've seen a lot of businesses that have had to close shop and decide another way to survive in, you know, this economy.
And the Commonwealth increasing the business's expenses and reducing their profits isn't helping.
Right. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us. I want to thank you for being a premier sponsor here on 95.9 and all of our sponsors who recognize the value of having, you know, advertising on radio, that it does indeed reach a greater audience.
We are so lucky to have this local social radio station. I hope people understand that and really appreciate what you guys do.
Well, we appreciate you, and we'll have to have you back on soon in the next couple of weeks, and we'll find another topic for you to be able to share your voice, because that's what this radio program is about, is sharing voices and talking about different topics and conversations,
Kevin,
that we have.
Can I encourage anybody that wants to come on to Monday Night Talk to get in touch with you and bring it?
They can.
All right.
There love he is. You. Jeff Yelanesian, yes, much love to you as well. You are tuned into Monday Night Talk. That does it for the first hour. We'll be back and here in just a few moments. You are listening to 95.9 WATD. Don't go anywhere.
WATD FM Marshfield, WBMS Brockton. This is the South Shore's radio station, 95.9 FM WATD. Streaming online at 95.9WATD.com. And with your smart speaker, just by saying play WATD. This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
That truck, it pays?
What?
The bumper sticker on that truck says it pays.
Pays? Pays what?
I can't quite read it. Oh, it pays to stay way back.
Ah, what was that?
The truck! Snap back or rock! Now I've got a broken windshield.
I'm Peter Brown of Tiny and Sons Auto Glass in Pembroke. It pays to stay way back. However, if your windshield is broken, just call 1-888-64-TINIES. And thank you.
Invest your time in listening to Cape Retirement Radio and learn a smarter approach to investing so you can protect your future. Cape Retirement Radio, featuring Chris Letond, Thursday nights at 6:15 and Sunday mornings at 10 on 95.9 WATD. Be a part of the show. Call in and join in on the conversation. 781-837-4900. Now, back to Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
Okay, welcome to the second hour of Monday Night Talk. And usually I like to try to do a regular update with some of our community partners. And, you know, sometimes we have folks from athletic parts of our community. Sometimes we have folks from our educational. Let's not forget the folks who are, you know, who are a little older, who have, you know, they've worked all their lives. Now they're enjoying the later part of their lives and are, you know, sometimes they like, you know, finding out what's going on in the community, especially when it comes to their Council on Agings and Council on Agings. That doesn't sound right, but their Council on Aging Centers. There we go. I fixed myself grammatically. The two individuals you hear chuckling in the background so happens to be Tammy Murray, who is the director for Hanover's Council on Aging. And we also have Susan Curtin, who is the director for Norwell. Ladies, welcome back to the radio program.
Thank you.
And again, I apologize for my itty bitty gaffe on my end. But how are things going with your respective centers?
Susan, you want to start?
Well,
you
sure.
Want to start? All right, I'm going to let Susan either. Start. Look, Kevin, I took over.
So things are going pretty well. We, you know, COVID, here we are almost 2 years later, and it's definitely created a lot of challenges for all the communities. But I will tell you, the one thing that has been constant is the senior centers. And we may have closed our doors at times, but we never stop working. And it continues to be that way today. So our center has been fully open since, we started reopening in May, and we brought all our programs back in full starting in September. We are still open, and with the uptick right now, we are trying to be cautious about that. So we have a mask requirement in place. Previously, it was optional for those who are vaccinated. Now it is currently required regardless of vaccination status. And, you know, we've stopped offering food for some of our programs. We're still on the fence about our congregate lunches right now. And we're asking people to just cooperate. We know no one really loves wearing a mask. But if this will help us to keep the center open, then that's what we're asking people to help us do. And that's our goal, is just to create a safe environment. So for now, that's our goal. You know, we'll continue to you know, look at things every day and see what happens, work with our Board of Health, and as they give us guidance, if we need to close down for a little bit, maybe we'll put things on pause, but we're still there and active and want people to visit with us.
Amy, how are things in your neighboring community in Hanover?
It's very similar. We recently requested that everybody wear a mask when they come in the building. I also opened probably May or June, and then added more programming in September. I didn't overbook our programming because we kind of had an idea that this was going to happen. So we are still open. I did not start serving food or coffee, which I know upset a lot of people. But if you have a coffee pot and everybody's touching it, to me, that just didn't seem like it made a lot of sense. We did recently get a cook, so we could start doing meals again, but we're using that person in the Board of Health. So it's been interesting. It's been a great opportunity for people that work in my Department of Community Services to learn other departments because we share a lot. We did this month cancel our crafting classes because that's really, it gets one-to-one where the painting instructor might come over and grab your brush, things like that. So we did stop that, but we're still doing whatever we can with social distancing in place. And again, we're just asking people to kind of work with us through it because I don't want to shut down again. We did get to open up a lot of the out-of-building outreach and services to people. So we really are still focusing on that. So people that don't get to the center are being recognized. But overall, I think we're all pretty tired and just want to do whatever we can to help this kind of subside.
I think, Kevin, if I can, the thing that's important, if, you know, for your listeners to understand, too, that we're two senior centers. And, you know, we have the opportunity to talk to our peers in other communities, and every senior center is different. So, you know, when we talk to each other as directors, you know, the things that we hear are, well, how come, you know, your community can do this, but this community can't do that? We hear that all the time. And what I think it's important for people to understand is that there are a lot of reasons behind the choices that we make. And sometimes it's driven by our town leadership. So if the town leadership says you need to close your building, then we close the building. You know, if they give us flexibility, then that's what we can do. So it's important for people to understand, one, to go and talk to the center and find out if they are open, because not all centers are open right now, or they're open in modified ways. But to also understand that there are a lot of decisions. We don't just randomly say we're going to close the center today. There's a lot of thought and consideration that goes into it, and sometimes it's not our choice. So I want people to understand that.
That is a huge point. Thank you for bringing that up, Susan.
I would have to ask that, and in knowing that what you respectively do, it's in the semblance of customer service, where, you know, you're trying to do your best to help with the older, that your community's older population, who have, you know, prior to COVID, enjoyed a lot of the aspects that, and I don't think folks understand what it is, some of the things that you offer, whether it's from exercise programs to if you have, if there's food donations, that those are provided. If someone needs fuel assistance, there's that. That there's so many things that you guys do, and you're so creative. You'll have authors who'll come in and talk about their books, and it runs the gamut. I've just been amazed, and that's why I always make sure there's room on this radio program to talk about what it is that the Council on Aging centers do for our older population. But at some point in time, do you find yourself having to kind of step away because there is that lack of understanding that sometimes folks can't and maybe not by any fault of their own, but they can't connect the dots, not understanding that, hey, what may go in, you know, Whitman doesn't necessarily go in Norwell, and maybe what they're doing down the road in Duxbury, they're not doing in Hanover.
Mm-hmm. I think I talk about this a lot to people, and there are a few things that I bring up. Is the scene, you know, we hear from when we talk to other agencies, when you see one senior center, you've seen one senior center, the old adage. And it's true because we all are unique, and we're unique for a number of reasons. One, every community is unique in their needs and interests and wants, but it also comes down to resources. And so what do we have for staffing? What's the funding that each community has? the number of volunteers and time and space as well. You know, I have a tiny little center. We're thrilled with the things that we are able to do in the small space that we have. And then there are larger centers that are able to offer so much because they have the space and the staff to do so. So that's part of the conversation, but I feel we can never step away from that. We always have to continue to educate our community and the communities around us about what we do. And I think that COVID has offered that opportunity to us. I really think instead of shutting the doors for the senior center, it's opened the doors for the senior center in different ways. It's allowed us to do a tremendous amount of outreach. And I think Tammy's in the same situation. You know, we called every single household that was registered with us. It was 1,500 households that we connected with just to say hi, friendly neighbor call. And as a result, we're seeing a lot of people who are now participating in programs or who are reaching out to us for the first time in other ways. Maybe they're turning 65. We hear about, you know, all these people who are all of a sudden retiring, right? So we're getting a lot of people coming in looking for SHINE counseling with us. So we continue to try and get that message out. And this is just another great forum to do that. But it's really up to us to be the advocates in the community to educate people. And we ask our boards to do it. And it's surprising and nice that a lot of the participants who come to the center do the same.
Amy, would you like to kind of expand upon on that?
Yeah, I think just from another side of it is she's right. We can't step away, but you know, you might have somebody who's mad at you on Tuesday who needs housing assistance on Friday. So you also kind of have to have like a thick skin and the ability not to take things personally so that you can continue to help the people that you're there to help and understand that maybe they're having a bad day or maybe they're having a situation that they need help with that they don't know how to ask for the help. So I think that's something that I've been blessed this year to teach my staff and model to my staff how to do that. We recently did a survey and we sent it out to, I believe, about 200 people that had used the center in a year's time. And we were up and down during that time. And some of the feedback we got back wasn't always favorable, but I was able to take little bits and pieces of that and use it to change the way we were communicating or, you know, get more information out to people. In Hanover, we've met, it was daily for a really long time, 7 days a week with the emergency response team. The town of Hanover has never lifted their state of emergency. So I'm bound to what this group of, I think there's 10 of us who meet weekly, if not daily, decide what's best for the community. And that was something that a lot of people really didn't understand. It's similar to how boards of health are leading their departments around, but it's just we're all doing it together, which is great because then if somebody's upset, you know, you have the bunch of you to lean back on. It's not one person making one decision. But yeah, that's just a different view of it. You have to have that like thick professional skin.
You are just tuning in. We're speaking with Tammy Murray. Tammy is, well, she was, I basically announced her as the person overseas the Council on Aging. She also is the Director of Community Services in the town of Hanover. And of course, Susan Curtin, who oversees the Council on Aging in Norwell. And we're talking about what it is, you know, enduring COVID and, you know, this latest spike, where do things stand with the, with Council on Aging, because they provide so much to our older population. You know, looking ahead, if you're allowed to, it does the current spike we're seeing right now put a pause on anything as you look ahead to 2022? Susan?
I would say we the only thing that we have real concern about is our congregate meal program, which has been limited to begin with, because our number, you know, we are reduced in the number of people that we can have on site. But no, we're cautiously optimistic that we'll be able to offer our programming. I think the thing that COVID has taught us was to be flexible. And, you know, the mechanism is in place right now for us to shift our programming from in-person to hybrid to virtual if needed. We've seen definitely an increase in interest. Not everybody will do that, but we can still deliver some of our programming pieces of it. The outreach aspect of it is stronger than ever. So, no, I think we're optimistic that we will be able to continue on. And again, we'll just take it day by day. People want to live their lives at this point. That's the thing. You know, we hear that from the folks that come to see us. And keeping in mind, if for the listeners, we serve the population, anybody who's 60 and older. And we're seeing a lot of people who are on the younger side. So recently retired in their late 60s coming in for, you know, whether it's consultations or stopping by for our grab and go events. That's been increasingly popular and we'll keep those going as well. But no, I think we're hopeful that things will continue on and be okay.
Big question, Tammy.
Yeah, I think I've been cautiously optimistic and taking one step at a time as we reopened, and I'll continue to do that. I think that one of the things that have brought a lot to the center is that we kept taking the SNAP applications, which is the food stamp assistant program, all through. And we also assist with housing applications and things like that. So we're getting a lot of younger people into the center that may live in housing in town that could be facing eviction or trying to move out. Or, you know, one thing that's come up a lot, which is interesting through this, is illegal apartments. For some reason, and I don't know why, people are realizing that where they're living isn't exactly how they should be living, and they're having to move out. So we've been really trying to help and focus on that. Hanover's looking at getting like a housing specialist to work out of the Council on Aging as well. Which would be great, because right now I'm the only one that has housing background, so it'll help us a lot. But so I'm really focusing on that kind of stuff. And the more we can add of the exercise and the meals and, of course, the crafting, which people absolutely love, and the Dementia Friends training that I've been doing, we're going to keep doing that. We're just going to have to do it at a smaller scale, like where we in October could have had 20 people. Maybe in February we can only have 10, you know, that kind of stuff. But we don't want to stop doing everything.
Could you expand upon the dementia training that you've been doing?
Yeah, it's really exciting, actually. Thank you. I was actually in the spotlight of their newsletter this month. It was kind of cool. So Dementia Friends is a program that was brought to Councils on Aging probably within the last year or so. It's a program that started in England. And they really, I have to say, overseas is awesome with their dementia and Alzheimer's training and the things that they try. And this program in particular just teaches people, any people, it could be a business, a staff member, someone in the community, the other side of Alzheimer's. So if you get dementia or Alzheimer's and it's slow moving, you could have it for 15 years and people find out you have it and treat you differently for it. So it gets into the aspects of what people who have it feel like, what people who are taking care of people who are living with it feel like. It's just, it's really fresh and fun. I've done 3 trainings so far and I've enjoyed every single one of them. There is training available. I'm called a champion, so I can train friends. And there is training available to become a champion, but I've also offered to go to other COAs and teach a class just so they can see what it's all about. It only takes about an hour or so. But I've always been amazed with how much people open up and discuss what they may have been through, or maybe they're dealing with a friend who was recently diagnosed with dementia. And it's just really cool. I love it.
Have you any workings with Dementia Friends or any workshops regarding dementia, Susan?
So we have not. Tammy and I have already been talking about trying to bring Dementia Friends training into our center in the spring. So she's offered to come and do that. And we actually, I was certified as a facilitator for the virtual dementia tour, and that happened just before COVID. So we have not been able to roll that out into the community just yet. But what that does is it's an evidence-based program that allows people to experience what it might feel like to have dementia. It's a fabulous program. So we're looking forward to it. We're hoping that maybe by the summertime we'll be able to bring people into the building and start running that type of program. What we are doing in the meantime, though, is we have a very strong, we too are part of the emergency management team. We have 2 new chiefs within the last year in fire and police, and we've been working closely to do some education around dealing with older adults. And part of that is bringing dementia training to our first responders. So we're working to bring that, hopefully this wintertime, we're on track to bring one of the regional reps in to do that for them. So we're working towards that as well. It's an important topic. The state has has been designated as dementia friendly. There are about 105 communities of the 350 that are designated as dementia friendly. And I know most of us are looking at trying to do that in the upcoming years. There's some funding available to do that through the community compact. So hopefully we'll be getting there soon.
I would ask, in regards to dementia, how has COVID had an effect when it comes to folks who have dementia? Has it had any effect, or has it hurt any of the services?
Absolutely. I know there's a couple day programs that lost their accreditation during COVID for no fault of their own. So that left people at home not knowing, you know, if you brought your wife every day to that program, then what do you do now? So there is definitely more of an isolation component since COVID.
Mm. I think we're seeing the isolation component regardless of you know, cognitive ability for sure. And like Tammy said, we're getting a lot of calls from people who are looking for any kind of support for their loved one who is experiencing dementia, because there are not a lot of day programs in the area, and some of them close their doors for a significant period of time. So especially when you have an adult child and you're helping to care for a loved one, you know, a parent who has dementia, and now all of a sudden you're working from home and you have to balance, you know, what do I do with my parent who can no longer go to a program, what do you do? So there have been a lot of challenges this year. And I think the other thing that we've seen in some of the folks that we work with is it's escalated the onset of it. Well, not the onset, but the progression of dementia, that it's definitely, you know, people who maybe were okay at the beginning, all of a sudden have had a tremendous decline.
I think it's worth noting is a couple of times during our conversation has been brought up about remote capabilities or hybrid. Have your respective centers been able to get some of those seniors who might have struggled previously with technology on board so that you can provide services or assistance to them? Susan? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we when we talk about virtual and hybrid programming, we talk about it not just online, but through cable. So we have a lot of our programming, and that was the first thing we did is try to get all of our fitness programs online so that people could still feel connected. So they are recorded for cable TV and air daily, but then also available to stream online for folks who want to do that. Yes. So that one component right there has been huge. We hear that all the time from people. I can't get to your class today. And it's helped us to reach people who would never come to the center because they can't. The technology piece of it, like iPads and whatnot, that's been a little bit more challenging. We have an iPad program we're rolling out to folks with some training to go along with it. I will say, though, virtual programming has been happening at our center for 7 years now, and it's definitely expanded in the last two. And we have seen numbers increase for sure in that.
Same with you, Tammy. Are you seeing any kind of an increase as far as folks, older adults who are engaging, using hybrid methods or virtual methods?
Yeah, we had a couple big programs during COVID. We did a memory training program, and we had joined a group, a consortium of some sort that used to do like virtual tours on the computer. I can't say it was an overwhelming response because it was hard to help people over the phone try and figure out like how to get there, things like that. There are still people that have problems even with a Zoom meeting. So that end of it's been difficult, but we have utilized our cable station as well. And I mean, I just got a call this week. One of the yoga classes didn't air at the right time, and I got a phone call right away. So I know people are still utilizing it, which is awesome. But it's been a challenge. I mean, there has been a lot of talk about getting the iPad programs and getting laptops out to people. I'd love to know how successful people have been with that. We didn't use our COVID money for that, but we do have training. We have the high school kids when we're able. We had to cancel this week. They come in and they help with phones or iPads or computers. But it's definitely been a challenge for a lot of the regular attendees.
Okay. And again, if you are just tuned into the radio program, we're speaking with Tammy Murray, as she is director for the Council on Aging in Hanover, also director for community services, and Susan Curtin, who is director for Norwell's Council on Aging. We only got like 4 or 5 minutes left before we wrap up. So what this is a basically a blank check for 2 minutes. Is there anything we haven't touched upon in regards to any updates with your respective centers, but you want to take a moment to at least talk about, Susan?
So a couple of quick things. It is wintertime now, so it's fuel assistance. We are the fuel assistance agent for the community, regardless of age. So if that's something that you need assistance with, to reach out to the center, our number is 781-659-7878, and we can certainly help you with that. Tammy mentioned we're helping people with SNAP benefits. The senior work program is coming back for us this year. So anybody who is interested in looking at that program, our meeting is going to be the 19th of January at 10 o'clock. We'll offer a Zoom option for that. We have a lot of things coming up, that the newsletter's online. We have a lot of grab and go events happening. We'd love to see folks for that. And I think the last thing is, I want to just thank everybody who has helped support our gift card drive around the holidays and help us get out to support people who are in need. We continue to accept gift card donations, and we right now we're looking for gift cards for Shaw's, Market Basket, Target, CVS, and Walgreens. We're really all set with Stop and Shop and Big Y. And we use those throughout the entire year to support older adults who are experiencing need. And this year has been very hard because the cost of food is increasing, the cost of medications is increasing, the Medicare, you know, what their Social Security went up, well, that's fine, but so did their Medicare costs. So people are really struggling financially right now. So we really greatly appreciate the support in the community.
Tammy, you got a couple of minutes left as well. Anything that you want to touch upon that we haven't discussed to this point?
I mirror everything Susan just said, a different phone number. But we're open to anybody who needs help. I think the community's learning more about that. But I wanted to bring up, I think this is like our fifth year having Susan on the show with us. So I just want to thank Susan for always showing up when you ask me and I ask her, because it's been great. And I think we've grown a lot and it changed a lot. So it's kind of cool to be able to be here. So, Kevin, I want to thank you for that, because it's really a great opportunity to get the word out.
Absolutely, I agree. It's wonderful to be included.
Well, again, the mission of the radio program itself is to touch all areas of things that are happening here on the South Shore. Is this the show kind of a magazine show? I mean, we could sit and talk about politics for 2 hours, but you know, we would lose part of our audience. So having different conversations about different things that will touch and better inform folks is what it's about. And let's not forget, is any time that I put the ask out, yourself, Tammy, and Susan, and the other council on Gretchen, we've had others who have been on who've joined us to deliver the information to their respective communities. And we also can do a compare and contrast as to what each community offers. And I think also we even got to put a little bit of a human touch on it as well, as to, you know, make folks realize that, you know, no two centers are the same, and whatever one community is doing doesn't mean another one is. You have to realize that. We apologize that, you know, but, you know, it's great that we're able to get that out to folks that, you know, if you are looking for information regarding programs and stuff, you know, that Council on Aging directors and the Council on Aging centers themselves are more than willing to go above and beyond to help their community members. So I thank both of you, and I thank all those who help our older population here on the South Shore and the Commonwealth. So thank you for joining me.
Thanks, Kevin. Thank you, Kevin.
Until the next time, we will step aside, and our last segment coming up, author Parb Mims, talk with her about her new book, The Captive, coming up in a few moments. You are tuned in to Monday Night Talk right here on 95.9 WATD.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
Hi, I'm Marianne Regan with the Scituate Animal Shelter. Our mission is to improve the quality of life for both companion animals and the people of our community. We're located at 780 Chief Justice Cushing Highway in Scituate. To get involved or to make a donation, please visit our website at scituateanimalshelter.org. Thank you, and please continue to support amazing nonprofit organizations on the South Shore.
I'm Ed, a volunteer with the Talking Information Center in Marshfield. Our mission is to provide human voice broadcasts of local news, articles, and items of interest to visually impaired and otherwise disabled listeners throughout Massachusetts to promote independence and enrich the quality of life. To get involved or make a donation, please visit ticnetwork.org. Please continue to support amazing nonprofit organizations on the South Shore.
Go ahead, indulge yourself. Every Wednesday night, tune in to Talk with Francesca and join me for provocative conversation, intriguing stories, and inspiration. So sit back and relax, or be stimulated, or both, because being connected feels good, and who doesn't need more of that these days? Don't miss Talk with Francesca Wednesday nights at 9 on 95.9 WATD.
Monday Night Talk continues all week long. Go to 95.9WATD.com/Monday Night Talk and keep in touch on Facebook and Twitter. This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
We have returned for the final segment of Monday Night Talk. Joining us is Par Mims. She is an author of the book, The Captive. And she's here today to tell us all about creating her book and what went into it. Welcome to the program, Par.
Hi, Kevin. How are you?
We're doing pretty good. We're doing pretty good. Just as we get things started, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay. Hi, I'm a Memphis writer. I'm a mother of four, and this is my first book, The Captive. I have a copy with me right here. I am writing other books, so be expecting some more from me later. I just have fun with it. That's all. Very free-spirited, stuff like that.
Okay. When did you know that you wanted to be a writer?
I've always written. Actually, I've just never done it professionally. Since I was a young girl, I've always wanted to write. I just never really had the opportunity to write. So I guess when it came up, I just took it. It just took it. But I've always loved writing. I've always loved literature. I just read all the time. I just love it. So, yeah.
That leads me right into my next question. do you have a favorite author or two? And what is it about the author that you like?
I do, but my authors are, my inspiration comes from very, very far. One of my favorite authors is Homer. He wrote the Iliad, and I know that's very, very foreign, but yes, I read classical literature like that. I also love William Shakespeare. I think I've read everything he's just about written. I love Maya Angelou. I love Toni Morrison. There are several authors that I just love so much, but I would have to say classical literature is definitely my favorite.
What types of writing have you done prior to writing your first book? Are you a short story person? Are you someone who's, written, limericks, stuff like that?
No, I've not done anything professionally writing. I've mostly focused on my career as my career did entail a lot of writing, but it was for other people. So I hadn't done anything professionally for myself. But my experience is basically the novels that I am currently writing. I have 17 and I'm publishing them. I've only published one, but I've not done anything professionally, just for other people. So, yeah, I've not done anything for myself.
Well, what about just like your own personal writings? Like, what have you written, short stories just as practice, or maybe poetry?
Yes, I do love poetry. I have quite a bit of poetry that I've written. I actually do have quite a bit of short stories that I've written just in practice that I said I was going to combine and make a book one of these days. So I actually do have quite a bit of those that I haven't done anything with. I just wrote them.
Okay. What was your inspiration behind this book that we're talking about, The Captive?
Oh, that's a very interesting book. Okay, well, my inspiration is my mom, of course. She had a few very sordid love affairs in her day. She did pass away last year. And I was just really depressed thinking about her. And I just was really lost. And I said, well, you want to know what? I'm going to create a fictional character that could have been her. So I think she was the inspiration behind my main female character, because I just was really sad. And it really helped me to get over her, just thinking about her. So I would have to say my mom. She's pretty much my inspiration for starting my career.
Did you feel that, was your mom always one who always coaxed you, saying, go ahead, do it, do it?
Well, actually, she had no clue that I even knew that I liked writing the way I did until she actually read one of my stories. So actually, it wasn't until about maybe 10 years ago that she learned that I even liked to write. But the person who had been coaching me were my children and my husband, because they were like, you need to do this, you need to do this, and you're good, and you're good. And so I tried it, and hopefully it worked.
If you will, could you give us a brief summary of the book, The Captive?
Yes, I can definitely do that. Okay, The Captive is about a young woman. She's fresh out of school. She's just now starting her life. She meets a guy, perfect guy, wonderful guy, or so we think he's a wonderful guy, but it's a really good story. It's a very different twist on a classic love tale. She gets herself caught up in this whirlwind romance that she just has no way of getting out of. In order for her to get out of it, blood has got to be shed. That's all I'm going to say. That's all I'm going to say.
Okay. So let's talk about the main characters. Now, you gave us an antithesis to how you wrote the book. Who are the, what are the names of the main characters that are in this?
Lauren is one of the, she's the female main character. Dave is the male main character. She has a best friend. Her name is Cameron. She's one of the main characters, and her sister, Macy. She's kind of a main character, but not really. But my main characters really focus on the plot of the story, because her best friend is really skeptical of a lot of things going on, because when you are too good to be true, literally you are too good to be true. So she's just like, you know what? You just got to watch this guy. And Lauren is so naive, because she's like, oh, I'm just out here free spirit and yada, yada, yada. And this is that, he's okay. And her Dave has got like a whole situation going on that he's just not letting up on. So Cameron, for the most part, kind of senses it, but Lauren is just oblivious, and she gets blindsided real bad, real fast. So yeah.
You say that this is a relatable story, that this is something that happens to people every day. They become smitten and become blind.
Definitely. That was also another reasoning behind it, because I mean, people get in relationships with people who they think they are, and they can come off to be so nice. And it doesn't take very long for a person to reveal them true colors. So with that being said, it's like you can just fall in love head over heels with a monster and just not even know it. And you can, male or female, both on both sides now, not double sided. And you can just basically get yourself caught in a situation to where you just had no clue you were in this deep. You had no clue this big hurricane was coming for you. And people often do that. Like, there are so many people that are missing today because they've gotten in relationships and didn't know anything about the person that they were getting in relationships with. So yes, this is very relatable. I would employ a lot of people to read this book, because it just gives you an idea of how people can trick you and how you can just not be aware. It doesn't matter how smart, pretty, funny, you can be tricked. It doesn't really matter. People will get you. And it's not like saying a bad way, but in a relationship perspective, people are going to use what they have to get what they want. So if they want you, they're going to trick you. Not necessarily, but it goes like that sometimes.
What makes your book different than other books that take a similar approach?
My book is different because I've decided to touch on a topic that very few writers have touched on. Even though it's a classic romance novel, it is a very dirty twist in this book. that very few writers do not touch because it often ends bad. Like, it's like, you shouldn't write about that. But I wrote my own spin, and I'm going to let the readers be the judge of that. But it's a very taboo subject in the book. And it's one of those subjects that people don't write about, which is what makes the book different, because you can write about romance and you can write about love and suspense, but the particular subject is not one that very many writers write about.
And if you're tuning in, we are speaking with Par Mims, and we're talking with her about her book, The Captive. Where does this take place? What is the setting? And The Captive, when I think of The Captive, I kind of think of this, some kind of a crime element to this. So if you will, again, where's the setting?
Okay. It takes place mainly in California, but there are several parts in Ukraine and also in Aspen, Colorado. Yeah, I know The Captive is a name that is indicative of, let's say, a crime, but is there a crime? Is there really? But when you read the twist to the story, you'll understand why it's the name The Captive, because you don't know who's the captive. Once you get done, it's like, I get it, but this is crazy. So it's kind of like, it takes place California, Aspen, and Ukraine. So you'll kind of get the idea of why those places I chose and the name also once you read it.
How long did it take you to write the book, and what was the process like for you?
It doesn't take me really long to write books because honestly, they sit up here for so long. So it's kind of like, it actually took me maybe 2 or 3 days to write this book, but that's only because it had been sitting in my brain for like 5 years. I don't necessarily know my process, because it's like when I'm writing a book, there's already a movie in my head. So I'm just basically writing what I see in my head. And I don't necessarily know if every writer thinks like that, but that's basically my creative perception of things. I don't really watch a lot of TV because I feel like it interrupts my own personal thoughts, and I don't want to just like incorporate anything. So I don't really watch much TV to get ideas. So just being clear-minded in a clear space really helps me to concentrate and get those stories out. But most of my stories have already been up there for quite some time.
Wouldn't you think that over time, as they're sitting there and they're maturating, that there would be settings would change, or as you're transferring the thought process onto paper, that there might be some changes, and as it's flowing, that you might go, maybe I might want to go in a different direction than this.
Yes, that has happened so many times where I've had to change the thought process because it looks a certain way in your head, but when you write it on paper, it just doesn't match. So when that happens, well, I do kind of get stuck. I get writer's block, but before I just frustrate myself out, I'll stop and give myself like maybe 5 minutes to just say, hey, you have to rethink this. You cannot do that. You just have to rethink this. So what I'll do is just sit up for a second and probably write maybe 30 sentences and just see which one fits better. Kind of like a plus and minus situation, because it does happen a lot. Like, basically you can see something, but it's really hard to write it. Like, you can say bang, but you have to make the reader see the explosion. So just because something exploded doesn't necessarily have to say, hey, this exploded. You really have to explain it. So yes, I have to rethink a lot of what I write, but it's, once again, it just comes to me after I get it out.
What was the editorial process like and having that first draft? Were you able to pass it on to somebody to look it over and make sure that it flowed? And were you able to keep the original draft as is?
I was not able to pass it on to anyone because my husband was like, I don't want to read it, when he got off work, because he was really tired. But I did give it to Archway, and Archway really liked it as it was. I didn't do any changes to it. I didn't need any editorial from them, so they didn't really help. When my editor did read it, she did enjoy it, and she only was saying, basically, we can't help with that because you've done everything. So I didn't really need any editorial help. It was just as is, basically.
Okay. Well, again, and when I ask that question of authors, the answers vary. I've heard similar answers to yours. I've had some where they've been told by the publisher, you might want to lose this or you might want to trim that. Again, everybody's different. The process is different for everybody. So when it came to choosing Archway, I mean, what was it like? Was it just a phone call? What was it like to get a publisher and have somebody who's on board with your writing?
You know what? Actually, for me, the process came fairly easy. I don't know why that is. A blessing, I would have to say, because I don't know. I've never written before. I just looked up the best publishers that I could work with, someone who I could work with long term, because I do have a lot of books. And I decided to choose Archway for no particular reason other than me doing research. And once I sent my manuscript in, they were like, sure, let's go. You have a great book. Let's do this. So that's what it was.
Now, as far as the cover art and anything else, what went into that?
Well, that was definitely Archway helping me publish, but the idea, of course, is mine. I use the lips to signify sensuality because it is a very sensual book, and the man in the background, he signifies just the persona of nice guy, but you just don't know. You just don't know. It just... basically various different versions of the book. Once you read it, you'll understand. So yeah, I just wanted something that would catch people's eye. And beautiful lips always catch people's eyes. So yeah.
Okay. So you send it in, they help you with the cover art. What happens then? Is it a matter of just sending it off to have it printed?
Yes, at that point, after you send it in and you guys get done with the rough draft, that's about a 6-week to 3-month process. So after that is done, they let you know that you can start telling people about your book coming out. And my book is print on demand, which means that they will print as it's being offered. So that's definitely a plus for me. So after that, they just basically said you can start telling people about your book. So I've been going hard promoting. Other than me turning it in, them making the copies, that was about it for me.
Now, did you get a set of books or did you just get a couple of copies?
I only got a couple of copies this time. So I just wanted to see how well it does because I'm very unknown. I live in Memphis. So I was just trying to promote myself. And hopefully once I write my next book, I'll have a nice fan base to be able to get copies because I would like to go and do personal signings for people. And I would like to travel. And I definitely would like to meet you in person also.
Absolutely. Come on up to Boston sometime.
I sure. It's very cold, so I'm going to wait till the summer.
Oh. So I would ask you, what was it like, you know, when you go through the process, as you said, that this is something that has, you know, been in your head for some time and
yes,
finally being able to get it into something that's actually, you know, a book. What was it like to hold, you know, your baby, your first book?
Very, very frustrating. See, I was already going through several things before I wrote my book. I was a government employee and I did get sick with the COVID. Yes. And my job just threw me away like a piece of trash. I mean, it was just a horrible thing. And that was the way I learned that I was expendable. I had gone to school, got my degree. I'd been a good employee. I'd been a good girl. I had worked so hard at the start of COVID because a lot of my coworkers are very older and they were just terrified. And I was like, I'm young. I mean, but I wasn't paying attention to what we didn't know about COVID in its extensity as it is now. But I was just like touching all on nasty things. And I ended up catching COVID right after my mom died. And my job was like, well, you're taking a lot of time off. And I'm like, do you not see what's going on in my personal life? And I was very frustrated because they forced me to resign. So I was stuck here just crying a lot. Like my mom had just died. Then my job just gives me the boot. And my kids are stuck home because of COVID. And I just was very depressed and sad. And I prayed about it. And in my dream, I was just like, you know what? When I woke up, I'm going to write, because it seemed like that's what I had a dream about. Like God was telling me, hey, you know what? you're expendable to them, but not me. Do what you love. And that was the process. I just turned positivity out of negativity. I just got tired of being thrown away and just decided to, hey, I'm going to go for broke. And that's what their process was.
So have you had a chance to hear back from readers? Has anybody given you any feedback on the book? And what was that like?
Well, I did get some feedback, and it was really good. I haven't had a lot because I don't think a lot of people know me. But from the feedback that I have gotten, which I'll say, honestly, about 4 people, because I don't know a lot of people, and I'm sure people aren't just reaching out. But from the people I know that have read it, they really did enjoy it. And also, they are waiting on me to write another book. So I guess that's a good thing. Yeah.
So I would ask you this, and that is that you've already said that you have other books that are in the works. Is The Captive, is it going to be, and this is without giving away the ending or anything, is it possible that The Captive could be a series, or is it a standalone?
Well, it could be a series. It definitely could take on a life of its own. So I am hoping for that. Fingers crossed. Yeah.
All right. And we are speaking with Par Mims. She is the author of The Captive. She has been our guest, and we have a few more minutes with her to chat with her about the book and help you understand where, if you wanted a copy of this, how you can attain a copy. What have you been doing to promote the book other than like doing interviews with me? What are you doing to kind of get your name out there so folks will want to buy a book?
Everything that I possibly can. Let me just say, I've opened up several pages. You can find me on Facebook. You can like my page. It's called The Author's Corner at Par Mims. So definitely check that out. Take a look. Also, my book is found on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. It's a global book, Booktopia. Go get it worldwide. It's everywhere. All you have to do basically is type in The Captive by Par Mims, and it's going to tell you all the locations. But Amazon would definitely be my first choice to go to simply because everyone knows it's easier to get it there. But it's sold in a lot of places, so you can actually go get it from bookstores also.
Isn't it great, the modern era? If it was 20 years ago, it would be basically the hard copy and you'd have to find a way to shuffle around and get the book out there. How great has it been, the digital age, to be able to share your book?
It's been so amazing. It has helped so much. I know I've reached much, much, much more of an audience than I would have versus not being in a digital age. I've been able to open up pages and show myself to many thousands of people that I just not would have been able to do that to. I've reached global audiences, and I know that without social media, that just would not be possible. So to be able to do this in a digital age is definitely helpful to me and my book. So yeah, I'm real excited about that.
This is your opportunity to give back to maybe those individuals who are, like you were prior, where you had the book, something already was already thought out, but you didn't go through the process of putting pen to paper. If you were to give any advice to any prospective writer, what would you give them for advice?
My advice would be, if you have a talent for writing, just go for it. Just go for it. Stop doubting yourself, because actually that is the biggest obstacle. That's the only reason I've never done it previously, because I was doubting myself. And that is the biggest obstacle, to be quite honest, because if you have a talent or if you don't have a talent, you don't know unless you put yourself out there. So just give up the fear. Do it, expose yourself. And if you don't like what you wrote or if people don't like it, then try again. But if you definitely have a hunger for it, I would say pursue it. Pursue it. It doesn't always go right the first time. Nothing does, to be quite honest. But if you have an urge and writing is a passion for me. So that's something that I would just never give up. So I would employ other writers to do that as well, no matter how hard it is, no matter how long the process is. If you want to do it, do it. You're not ever going to know if you don't. Like, fear and doubt are going to keep you stuck. So just get rid of it.
How important has positive reinforcement, whether it's support from your friends and family, to be able to at least make this happen?
positive reinforcement is one of the most amazing tools ever. Because if you don't have someone telling you you can, a lot of the times you won't. And if you're already in a bad place mentally or wherever you are, just if you're not in a good place and you don't have any type of positive reinforcement, it's going to hurt. It's going to kill the process. Positive reinforcement brings about creativity. It helps. It just helps it flow better. You do need that positive source to push you because you will get down on yourself. And I mean, everyone does that. But just as a writer, when you live in your mind already. So it's like if you don't have someone telling you, hey, take a break, calm down, you can do this. You will give up so fast. You'll find yourself somewhere just so frustrated because the process is frustrating. People think writing is easy. It's not because talking is easy, but writing is very hard. It's very hard to write something everyone can understand and relate. So it's very hard. And you want to make sure you incorporate everyone into your audience. You don't want, well, me personally, I don't want a select audience. I want everyone to be entertained. It's not like, well, I have this audience or that audience. I want everyone to be entertained. So it's kind of a process to do that. And so that's what I was looking for.
Got about a minute or two left. Is there anything that you have not been asked during this discussion, but you feel is important to at least leaving with our audience?
Well, I think, Kevin, we covered pretty much a lot of things, but I did want to say I do have two books coming out. One is called Lady in the Cellar, and it is also a suspense thriller. And I also have another book called Carver City. It's coming out. This is a really good book. It's kind of an action thriller type book. And they are going to be coming out. One is coming out this month, Lady in the Cellar, and Carver City is coming out in February, and I really hope you guys enjoyed it. I really enjoyed my interview with you, and I just want to say thank you for getting me out there to a broader fan base, and I just look forward to this new adventure.
Are you going to do anything in regards to either Kindles, like digital media? Are you going to do that and also audiobooks? Is that an option for you?
Yes, they are actually an option. I do have Kindle and audiobooks, so you guys can check that out also. So, yeah, they are definitely available with the team I'm working with. All the reading formats you possibly need. Yeah, I got them all.
Okay. And again, if folks want to find you, I don't know if you have a website or if you have a contact page, how can they find out more about you and the book?
Okay. Yeah. So definitely I do have a website. It's called The Author's Corner at Par Mims. You can reach me on Facebook. Just type in The Author's Corner and you can like my page and you can go on and you can find out some other things about me. I post regularly on the page. So I try to keep in touch with fans basically or with people who are interested. And if you want a copy of my book, you can go to Amazon, just type in The Captive by Par Mims. Or you can just go on your Google and type it in and go to whatever store you prefer because it is a book that's in a lot of brick and mortar places. And I love brick and mortar places. Like I will sit in Barnes and Nobles and read. So I highly suggest we get out just a little bit. Be safe, of course. Wear your mask. If you're not vaccinated, just basically do all of those things you need to be safe because we have to get back out there. Because I want these books to be a movie and I need you guys to go to the movies. Like, don't sit at home. Don't be stuck. Just go get out. Let's do this, people. Let's have a life again. Let's be smart. Let's be safe. Let's be conscious of each other. And let's just do this because I really want this to just work. And let's just, you know, let's just have fun with it, man. Let's just go.
She is Par Mims. She is the author of The Captive. She has been our guest. I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Kevin. You are so awesome. I look forward to meeting you.
And with that, that is all the time that we have been given. Fear not, though. We will be back next week at 6:15 p.m. Until then, have a great evening and have a fantastic Thanksgiving. You've been tuned in to Monday Night Talk here at 95.9
Marshfield, WBMS Brockton. This is the South Shores Radio Station, 95.9 FM WATD. Streaming online at 95.9 WATD.com.